David Peters, and I'm from the University of Wisconsin, over at River Falls campus, which is 20 minutes outside of St. Paul. And what I'd like to have us think together about today is an issue I know that Washingtonians have thought about in the past, because you had a referendum here not too long ago concerning whether the state of Washington ought to legalize something like Dr. Jack Kevorkian has been doing over in my home state of Michigan, where I hail from. There was also a referendum in California, a referendum in Iowa on the same issue over the last 6 or 7 years. The referenda were voted down, but that doesn't say much. There's an old adage that every idea has to have its gestation period, or all great ideas start out being heresies. And so simply because it got killed by the voters early on doesn't mean that it's not going to come back for examination. In fact, it did come back for examination in Oregon. And last November, Oregonians passed their first death with dignity law, which is of an interesting stripe. It would authorize, it would make legal a physician prescribing a lethal dose of certain medication, which could be taken by the patient him or herself. And there are some constraints on this nonetheless. And so Oregon has already been the first to make the move. We're exercised by this particular issue for a number of reasons. And I find it rather interesting in this country that the mode of, there are really two modes of physician-assisted deaths. One is the Jack Kevorkian type, where Jack simply provides you with the means for you to take efficiently your own life. He'll provide you with his dripping three bottles, and you press the big red button, and the saline solution starts, and then some sort of analgesic starts, and then the potassium cyanide or whatever kills you. But you see, there, the button pusher, the doer of the act, is the patient him or herself. And so that's called physician-assisted suicide. Over in the Netherlands, they've gone one step further. Netherlands law now permits, again under severe constraints, physicians themselves to administer lethal doses. Now please note who the acting party is. The physician is the injector of the syringe of the lethal dose in hopeless medical patients who request this. Of course, there's a lot of conditions. They've got to be proven to be hopeless and mentally competent and on and on and on. I think it's rather interesting in this country that, to my knowledge, except for exotic law review articles that are seriously trying to argue that the constitutional right of privacy and so forth permits us to go the way Holland did. I mean, there's nothing constitutionally illegal about authorizing physicians to inject lethal doses, despite the fact that this discussion about should we institute Netherlands-style euthanasia here, you don't hear too much about it in the popular press. All the fighting seems to be about physician-assisted suicide. This strikes me, and maybe the American public thinks, well, this is a little bit less radical with the little r rather than the big r. Then one of the issues here is there a distinction really that's worth a moral difference between these two? If you're going to go for one, well, why not go for the other? What I'd like, first of all, mainly I want us to get into an argument with Mela here shortly. I want to act as something of a pump primer by trotting out some arguments in front of you here, many of which I hope you won't sit there and say, oh, that's fine. I'm sure you're going to find some of these outlandish or outrageous, which is exactly what it is we have to talk about. But Let's see if we can just get situated conceptually in this, I'm just going to call it generically, the euthanasia debate. I didn't know, I never really thought about this. I guess I knew it in the back of my mind, but I never really thought about this. The brute word euthanasia is really a Greek word. The last part here, thanasia, comes from a Greek word thanatos, which means death. And the little EU, the epsilon, opsilon, is a Greek prefix which simply means good. So, I mean, it's rather interesting that the meaning of euthanasia is inception, or etymologically, is as much as nothing more than the good death, period. But in the modern discussion, we've come to make a lot of more fine-tuned distinctions, and let's just try and get oriented as to what we're going to be talking about today. We've generated a whole vocabulary concerning euthanasia within the last couple of decades. Let's just look at this matrix. Physicians, attorneys, philosophers sometimes like to distinguish between what's called passive euthanasia and active euthanasia. What's passive euthanasia? Well, the synonym for that is often letting die. Concretely, what it involves is either the withholding of life-preserving therapy, I mean, if it hasn't been given yet, or the withdrawing of life-sustaining therapy if the person is already on the tubes or whatever else that they have to be doing. Here, the argument is that all you're doing is let nature take its course. If you've got a hopeless cancer patient, you're just not going to do anything more to keep the person alive. You're going to let death come, et cetera, and so it gets the notion of letting die. Active euthanasia often has the name mercy killing. Mercy killing. This is what's going on over in the Netherlands. In the Netherlands, you have an actor, namely the physician, who upon patient's request injects a lethal dose, and of course, death comes faster, right, by the lethal dose than it would even if you pulled the person off of life-sustaining medications. Morphine is going to take your life within hours. The cancer that's killing you may take months. So technically this is called killing, and it's called mercy killing. Now, there are two cross-cut distinctions here. One is voluntary and the other is involuntary forms of each. Now, if a form of either of these is voluntary, just in case the patient, him or herself, requests it by the request of the patient. And of course, it ends up being involuntary if either of these modes of euthanasia are practiced without the request of the patient. I mean, somebody might be in a coma, they might be hopelessly senile, might be a young infant who can't even speak, and so forth. So you can have involuntary forms of each. Now, we've already made up our mind, collectively, that letting die, voluntary forms of letting die, are okay. And my evidence for this is that every state in the Union, including the District of Columbia, now has what's called a living will law. I mean, what do living wills do? You can simply produce an advanced medical directive that said, if I get an XYZ in circumstances, I just don't want heroic measures and so forth continued, and on and on and on. So you're authorizing your physicians or caretakers to either withhold, in hopeless medical circumstances, life-sustaining medical care, or to withdraw it if you're already on it. So living will legislation shows that we've made up our mind about this, the letting die, the voluntary forms of letting die. So we have settled that issue. The Netherlands is doing this, and we've not yet risen to that particular challenge in this country. But Let's just go back to where we are. I want to start small and then build to a big finish here. I mean, let's just go back and ask, what sorts of reasons drove us collectively as a nation to authorize living will laws which allow for voluntary passive forms of euthanasia? Well, let me lay out what I'll call the model case. The model case. Conceive, if you will, of a patient who has a terminal condition certified as being terminal by, let's see, three independent consults of physicians. Imagine that this patient also is suffering great pain that cannot be relieved effectively by available analgesics. So you have somebody in intractable pain. Imagine further that this patient is very knowledgeable about the medical options available. They've been walked through the various alternative therapies which are available, the risk benefits that go with each. They've heard all this from their physician. Maybe they've talked to other patients on the ward. So we have somebody that's very knowledgeable about what their options are. And let's just suppose that the same patient has long considered his or her circumstances, has pondered this for a long time, and now requests that they no longer, that their life no longer be preserved artificially by medications and therapies. They regard that as nothing more than prolonging their dying, and they want out. Now, I think what drove us collectively as a nation to buy into living will legislation is because we would look at a patient with all of these, terminal condition, intractable pain, completely knowledgeable of the alternatives, having made up his or her own mind that the life ahead of them, the reasonable prospects, is the life that they themselves consider not worth living. I think we looked at this and simply said, if we don't accept this patient's request to be let to die by withdrawal or withholding, if we don't do that, we're just being cruel. We're preserving in this world a life of agony whose subject doesn't want this to go on. And if the law is in this business of disallowing the withdrawing or withholding of aid, then the law seems to be in the business of perpetuating cruelty, mind you, and we think the law should never be in that business, and therefore there shouldn't be any law against it. And this is how we came to this. But let me try and I should say one more thing before we move the next step and ask, well, why not go all the way to Holland? I will concede that the fewer of these conditions just enumerated are fulfilled in a given case, the more hesitant we become to think, oh, we ought to authorize letting die in this case. Suppose a patient really doesn't suffer from a terminal condition. Start to back off. So suppose the patient is not in intractable pain. Suppose the patient decides, oh, I want all the plugs pulled and everything, 30 seconds after hearing this bleak diagnosis, without having thought about it. I mean, if any of these things come in, they sort of muddy the waters, and we sort of back down and say, oh, well, that's no longer the model case. I'm not sure I want to authorize it there. But here's where the plot begins to thicken, or maybe sicken. Let's just take our classic patient, which drove us to living will legislation. Conceive of somebody who has a terminal condition. They're in unrelievable pain. They're fully aware of the details of their hopeless circumstances. They've unswervingly been committed that death is preferable to the type of life they're now living in, which by all medical indications they will continue to live. Now, here's the magic moment. I submit that what you have in your hands is a patient, and probably the clinicians that are going along with this believe this too. Suppose that everybody, medical attendees as well as patient, think and concede that the best thing that can happen to this patient is for the patient to die. I mean, you've already made up your mind that death is the friend. It's not the enemy. Death is the savior. I mean, suppose you've conceded this, then here's where an interesting line crossing comes. I mean, if you say it would be inhumane in the same circumstances to refuse the patient's request for the withdrawal or withholding of life-sustaining aid. Now, mind you, what you know when you withdraw or withhold life-sustaining aid, isn't it true, is that you know that the patient is going to die quicker than if the patient were continued on this aid. Okay? You understand this. The withdrawal, withholding is a hastening of death. Now look at this Rubicon. Let's just suppose you've got all of these conditions fulfilled. Hopeless, intractable pain, terminal condition, and so forth. And the patient is crying out for release. The patient has made up his or her mind that death is the best thing that can happen. Why not hasten death? We've already agreed that this is a death hastening. Why not hasten death by immediately injecting a lethal dose, which puts the person out of their misery even quicker than withdrawing or withholding aid, which will allow the patient to die, typically over days, weeks, or months in agony and decay. You see, the point here is that you say, well, we should not refuse a patient's request. The sooner death comes, the better it's going to be. This is what we've made up our mind about. But then when you compare the options here, the technical options, this can bring death even sooner. So why not go this way? Why not? Because you've already agreed to the conditions that death is the best thing that could happen. Well, at this point, the American Medical Association heart starts to palpitate a bit. Mm-hmm. Because they look at this and they say, no way. No way. In 1972, in 1988, in 1991, they came out with statements of their code of ethics. Everyone subscribes to the AMA, subscribes to this. And the first couple of purple paragraphs here say that the AMA is fully in accordance with ceasing treatment when all hope is lost and blah, blah, blah. I mean, they're conceding that letting die with consent of the family and the patient and everything, I mean, that's cool, but they categorically reject injecting any poison or anything. We're right back to the Hippocratic Oath, which has a paragraph in there, refuse to do it. And they simply say, well, that we can't get into. It's against everything medicine has stood for. We can't have anything called Dr. Death. I mean, that's like a oxymoron or something. I mean, a Dr. Death. It's meant to be a paradox, is what Jack's label is now. And so they completely throw out, ethically, that killing could possibly be the mode of hastening death to relieve intractable pain and hopelessness, but letting die is okay. Well, there is a philosopher whose head I admire a lot at the University of Alabama, and his name is James Rachels. And he suspects that the American Medical Association comes to their conclusion that they're in favor of letting die, but no way with mercy killing, no way with lethal dose injection. He suspects that what's behind the AMA's view is a mixed up intuition. And let me just state the issue, this mixed up intuition, which he thinks drives it. Of course, I think he suspects that we all are party to the same intuition, and he's going to try and blow it out of the water. He suspects that the AMA subscribes to this view, that letting die, if something can be correctly called a case of letting die, well, that's morally permissible. But if something can be correctly called a case of killing, It's never morally permissible. And what is injecting a lethal dose except killing? Now, observe what this hunch is. I mean, the wager seems to be that letting dies are morally okay, but killings can't work. I mean, that's if something can correctly be called a killing, it's morally wrong. We could probably already smell why this ain't going to work. But he gives a lovely example. He's famous for a lot of famous cockamamie examples to illustrate philosophical points. But he tries to blow out of the water this particular hunch or this intuition which the AMA operates on. Letting die is okay. Killing is always morally wrong. By giving us the famous Smith and Jones example, he asks us to imagine a guy named Smith who's alone in a house one night with a six-year-old cousin. And the circumstances are such that if anything happens to Cuz, Smith will inherit a gigantic fortune. And you can imagine sort of an Edgar Allan Poe mystery house and so forth. And Smith says, tonight's the night, I'm alone with a kid. He's up there taking a bath or something. I'm going to go up and kill him. I'm going to make it look like an accident, and I will inherit the great fortune. So he strides upstairs, walks in the bathroom, takes the child's head, forces it underneath the water, and the child expires. And what did Smith do? Well, the answer is, well, Smith killed his cousin. Fade to gray. Come back. Guy named Jones. He, too, is alone in a house, and he, too, upstairs has a cousin, 6 years old, such that if anything happens to Cuz, he's going to inherit a giant fortune. Notice what Rachel's trying to do, trying to keep everything equal, okay? Smith, or Jones, makes up his mind, tonight's the night. I'm going to go up there and kill a kid, inherit the great fortune, make it look like an accident. He goes up to the bathroom, walks into the bathroom, and you can imagine maybe the kid sitting there with his dial soap or something, and just as Jones walks in, ready to kill the child, he just slips on the bar of soap, his head hits the shower fixture, he falls face down in a bunch of residual water, and he's drowning, and Jones and does nothing. And a child dies. Now the question is, what did Jones do? He let the child die. Didn't kill him. I mean, Smith killed his cousin. Jones let him die. Now let's go back to the hypothesis we're entertaining. If killing as such, simply because it's killing, is morally worse than letting die, you and I all have to say that Smith is more of a scoundrel than this Jones. And nobody here is going to say that. Nobody. Now, what are we supposed to learn from this? Well, what Rachel is trying to get us to believe is that the bare, nude, raw distinction between killing and letting die doesn't have any moral import at all. We have to know a lot more about the circumstances of killing and letting die, right? I mean, just think for a minute. There are probably few of us here who are just card-carrying pacifists that will never bear arms, even if we're attacked with a knife. I mean, killing in self-defense, most of us regard as morally okay. Maybe even killing in war. Maybe even killing in capital punishment. See, now we got a group of killings which wash whitely because good moral reasons can be given for them. But then, of course, you got a group of killings that don't wash. I mean, the Jeff Dahmer kind of stuff just doesn't cut it. I mean, no one's going to morally bless that kind of stuff. But likewise with letting die. Simply to know that it's a case of letting die settles nothing interesting ethically, does it? I mean, Jones let his cousin die, and a lot of physicians let their patients die. I mean, they're all letting die, simply knowing that it's a case of letting die. If somebody says, hey, Jones or Smith let Anderson die. What do you think about that? I mean, what Rachel would say is, would you like to tell me more? I mean, I don't know enough to make a moral judgment. So the raw, nude, bare distinction between killing and letting die holds no moral importance at all. I mean, if there is a moral distinction, between the lettings die of physicians vis-a-vis patients and Jones with respect to his cousin, other things have gotten to come into pot. I mean, arguably his cousin didn't want to die, but that's probably one of the big differences between the patients we're talking about. They do want to die. The cousin's hope of a decent future life is probably plausible. The hope of a decent future life for the patient is not there, you see. But these are the things that mark the moral difference. Now, where are we going with all this? At least we can reopen the debate as to whether we should authorize Netherlands kinds of voluntary active euthanasia. I mean, simply to say, oh, but that's killing. You know, that's what the AMA says. I mean, Rachel would say, so? So what? Notice, and Rachel's is fond of pointing this out, that if we choose to deal with these hopeless, screaming, meanie, pained patients by simply withdrawing, withholding aid, so that they are allowed to die in agony and decay over weeks or months, when another alternative is available, namely putting them out of the misery quickly, of course at their request, then to choose this rather than this is to choose the least humane course. I mean, if humanity is what's driving us in all this, then this the Netherlands thing starts looking like the better way to go than what we're doing with living wills. Now, what Dr. Jack is doing over there is sort of a splinter off on this. I mean, he's sort of in the killing business, but he's simply providing people with machinery to kill themselves quickly. Not over, you know, it's not a letting die or anything. So this is the arena we're talking about, and we can walk, you know, both sides of the street, either talk about should we enact Netherlands-style euthanasia legislation, should we go with Oregon and authorize physician-assisted suicide. Anyway, this is where the debate is about. Now, let me just do a couple of things here, and then I want to get some responses from you. We're just going to touch the tip of the iceberg. Remember what the argument was which convinced us that we should build a living will legislation? It sort of ran, cruelty is an evil. It's cruel to force a person to go on in agony and decay when all hope is lost, when there's a technical means of releasing. It's cruel to do that. And then the third premise was something like, and if the law is in the business of forcing people to go on in this kind of hopeless existence because it will not authorize physicians paying attention to patients' requests, we condemn the law as being an accomplice of the perpetuation of cruelty, and that's why the law ought to be changed. Remember that? Well, can't the same argument be run as to why we ought to authorize Netherlands-style euthanasia? I mean, all the premises work. All the premises work. One argument does not a case make. Let me give you another argument as to why we should either go for Kevorkianism or Netherlands-style euthanasia. Let's just call this the argument from liberty. Each one of us has sort of cut our teeth on the American way, which everyone wants to be free to be me. We want the maximum freedom to live our life as we see fit, and the Constitution gives us this. And so we've sort of collectively come to the notion that the law should never, without just cause, interfere with our living our lives as we see fit. And we've probably collectively agreed that the law has the right to step in and say, well, I know you want to act in such and such a way, but we're not going to let you do it. We've collectively agreed that the law can do that if the way you want to act in a particular circumstance will give significant harm to others. That's where we blow the whistle on it. You can live your life as you see fit up to the point that you intrude on others living their lives as they see fit, that you muck up their lives, that you harm them in some way. We don't like paternalistic reasons for the law saying, I'm not going to let you do that, where the law comes in and simply says, while what you're doing, and we're not going to let you act against your own best interest. We hate that. Of course, we got paternalistic laws up the kazoo. I mean, you know, everything from Social Security on down. But liberty is a precious commodity for us. Well, let's take a look at it. We have this major premise that the law ought not to restrain individual liberty unless there's doggone good reason for doing so, especially the reason where if you could show that a kind of action is liable to do significant harm to others. So let's take a look at our classic patient. Terminal, pain-racked, hopeless, thought about their condition for a long time, prospects are bleak, and they want out. Now let's just cast about, okay? The law right now does not allow physicians to administer lethal doses upon patients' request because no jurisdiction that I know of allows the defense, but she asked me to do it. I mean the consent of the victim in our country is not an appeal to get you off a murder one charge. It isn't. But let's just ask as to whether the existing laws might fare poorly with respect to these conditions we just laid down. So we have a patient that wants to end his or her own life for the reasons just given. Now let's just ask, if we were to allow the patient to live their life as they see fit, in this case meaning taking a lethal dose from a physician, if we put out an all-points bulletin for a harmee, if we allow the person to do it, can we turn up one? Would the patient be harmed? Probably not. In his or her own judgment, it's the best thing that could happen. Would the patient's family be harmed? Well, of course there would be harm in a sense of grief at the loss of a loved one, but that's going to come anyway, later if not now. And they may already be breaking out of the financial and psychological strain, so they might consider it a gift. How about the nurses, the doctors? Are they likely to be harmed? I think not. Insurance companies? I think not. I mean, when you just look around and say, you know, well, anyone who's likely to be a harmee, hold up their hand, the odd thing is you can't seem to turn up a harmee. Now, this is rather interesting, because you have a restriction on individual freedom, which is not justified on the standard ground of, we've got the restriction in place, because we can't allow people to do this, because if people do this, they harm others. So we seem to have a law that restricts freedom without justification. So the plot begins to thicken a bit more as to why we probably should cross this line, or why there might be good reason for it. But look, the opposing camp is not made up of a bunch of lightweights. The pro-life movement has some powerful spokespersons. And let me just run by you a couple of sample arguments as to why, and I think they're good arguments, as to why anti-euthanasia people think that we should not touch this kind of legislation with a 10-foot pole. There are hundreds of reasons that they can give. One I sort of want to do away with quickly because I just don't think it works. The standard, you know, in logic, if you take a class in logic, you learn about what are called slippery slope arguments, opening wedge arguments, camel's head under the tent arguments. They're all, you know, metaphors for arguments that have the following form. Don't you dare take the first step, because there's no way if you take the first step that you aren't going to be slide and take the second step and the third step, and you're going to go to hell in a handbasket, okay? So, I mean, and there's no way of preventing a fall all the way down to terribleness. Well, standard arguments against euthanasia simply say, don't you dare even allow physicians to inject lethal doses in hopeless cancer patients, because there's no way of preventing us going all the way to Hitlerian Germany, right? I mean, that's the logical end result. You take the first step, you're on a banana peel slide. I mean, you know, it's going to go there. I don't think that's a very good argument. but it's one that can be given. Let me give you some better ones. What some pro-life people and anti-euthanasia people are worried about is this. The rhetoric at the outset in getting us to pass euthanasia of the Netherlands type or Jack Kevorkian type, authorizing it, it's going to keep using this language called the patient's right to die. Right to die. And then what some of the pro-life people, I think, astutely point out is that an interesting metamorphosis might happen. Yeah, let's just suppose that we pass this legislation. It's a fait accompli. We either have authorized Kevorkianism or authorized Netherlandism. And so now everybody knows that it's the patient's legal right to request the lethal dose, to request Dr. Jack's free dripping bottles, whatever it happens to be. Everybody knows. So the patient's going to know it. The family's going to know it. The doctor's going to know it. The hospital administrator's going to know it. Now, let's add in another factor. Cost for keeping a patient alive. Suppose the patient's in an ICU ward. I don't even know what they cost nowadays. $3,000-$4,000 a day? When the cost of maintaining you starts going up and up and up, then what the pro-life people point out is that we're liable to see an interesting metamorphosis. The question is going to come to a patient who chooses not to elect the lethal dose, and it's going to be sort of a pressure: is what? Why aren't you availing yourself of this liberty? Do you have any idea what it's costing for your care? I mean, what I'm talking about is this metamorphosis of the right to die into Governor Lamb's duty to die. I mean, could it happen? Is this a reasonable scenario? People are worried about it. We're also worried about whether we can really hold the line. Almost all the legislation I've ever seen that is given, presented as bills, always say, well, we're only going to authorize lethal dose injections or physician-assisted suicide if the patient has a terminal condition. I've got to nail that sucker down. Terminal condition. What the heck is a terminal condition? I worked at a hospital for a couple of years, you know, and I went around and I heard people, terminal condition, terminal condition.
You're all terminal.
Life is a terminal disease.
Well, that's the perception. This is the perception. I mean, somebody with end-stage renal disease has got a terminal condition. Someday it's going to get them. Of course, they can go on dialysis 3 or 4 times a week and probably live 20 to 25 years, but they got a terminal condition in the bald sense that it's going to get you. Likewise with certain forms of diabetes that you can minister to with insulin. Now, these are terminal conditions if all you mean by it is that it's going to kill you someday. Well, what do you mean by a terminal condition? Well, I finally figured out in the hospital staff at the place where I worked, and you can't go to the Merck medical manual or anything or get anything. I mean, it's just sort of way people use words. What most of clinicians seem to mean by a terminal condition is that the patient has a condition that he or she will die of in 6 months to a year, even if everything is done. Now, that's sort of what they mean by it, okay? But I think that one of the worries here is the elasticizing of the notion of a terminal condition. And this is what the pro-life people are worried about. That if some patient has got some disease, I had a nephrologist tell me one time about the patients that he has that have sickle cell anemia, black patients, and they've got to go in 2-3 times a week for a 3-hour blood cleansing, you know, at a time and so forth. Now, they can go on like this for maybe 20, 25 years, have a relatively functional life. But this nephrologist said that many of them have simply said, you won't see me again. This is my last dialysis. Like, why? I don't want to go on with this. I really don't. Well, here's... this is interesting, because the patient could rightly claim that he's got a terminal condition. No one's going to gainsay that. They do. He said, but there's such a long life you have ahead of you. Yeah, but I got a terminal condition. All you're asking for is a terminal condition. I gave you one. I satisfy the requirement. Well, this makes us uneasy. It makes the pro-life people uneasy. Then the next thing the pro-life people are worried about, not just elasticizing the notion of terminal condition, like by hypothesis, you want terminal condition. I mean, you don't want just people, physicians, shooting up jilted lovers because they can't go on. I mean, do you? I mean, you got to have something in there to keep this thing from getting out of hand. So if you're not going to elasticize the notion of a terminal condition, you simply say, well, let's get rid of it. Let's disband the criterion of terminal condition that you don't like. And what would drive people to say this? Well, among other things, that would point out that there are some conditions, probably if we did a Yankelevich survey in here, that every one of us would regard as horrible conditions, and we probably wouldn't want to go on like this. Comas, persistent vegetative states, but those aren't terminal conditions. Nobody dies of comas. But there they are. You know, someone is like Karen Ann Quinlan, 10 years in a persistent vegetative state, being fed by food IVs or gastrostomies or something. Is that a desirable kind of a life? I think not. I wouldn't want to go on like that. But somebody said, but you eat terminal, Peters, so we can't allow your request to pull the food IVs and kill you. Well, somebody said, well, that's reasonable. Why do you want to saddle yourself with a terminal condition? Aren't there all kinds of things out there? Janet Atkins, who was the first woman done in by Dr. Jack in 1990 in the back of his VW van over in Michigan. Anybody know what her problem was? Alzheimer's. In the beginning stages of Alzheimer's. The week before she died, she beat her 32-year-old son in a tennis match. She used to hang glide, skydive, mountain climb. Life wasn't, she couldn't do that anymore. You know, she couldn't play her flute. Of course, there's all kinds of stuff she could do. I mean, she could read and have heavy-duty intellectual conversations. Well, Janet's life was worth living. But I've come to discover, apparently, I didn't used to think that. I thought that Alzheimer's was just plain a neurodegenerative disease that never claimed anybody's life, but I find that that's not really true, that it is a life claimer. So in that sense, it's terminal. But what about Janet Atkins? I mean, say, my God, she had a chance for a zestful, vibrant life. She could claim that she had a terminal condition. Well, let's just get rid of terminal conditions. I mean, we don't want to saddle ourselves with that. There are all kinds of terrible states that are not terminal conditions, and certainly, if somebody wants to be released from it, we shouldn't just saddle them with a terminal condition. Now you could now you can see what the pro-life people would say. Ah, wait, would you like to tell me what the next step is? I'll tell you what they did in Holland. It just blew the lid off it here. This is, what, 2 years ago? A 50-year-old woman by the name of Hilly Boscher showed up at a psychiatrist's office. His name was Chabot. She spilled the story out to him, which takes your heart away. She had just gotten out of a 25-year abusive marriage. Both of her sons had died, each at the age of 20, although at different times. One had committed suicide, the other had died of some terrible cancer. And she showed up at Chabot's office and said, I want you to help kill me. And he didn't say, oh, I can't do that, because he is a physician and he is under Netherlands law. So, I mean, she had that right. And like a good clinical psychiatrist, he tries to plumb what it is that's troubling Hilda, whatever her name was. And he's in like 4 months of counseling with her. And he feels like he's getting nowhere. I mean, this woman keeps saying, I want to go. And I don't want to blow it. I want to do it efficiently. I want you to help me. Will you help me? He consults with a number of other psychiatrists and just sort of informally explains off the cuff what Hilly's circumstances are, and they concur that on the basis of what they heard, they have a personal examiner, and this is on the basis of what they heard, she sounds hopeless. So Chabot, the psychiatrist, finally says, okay, I'll help you. And so he prescribed to her and was with her. I prescribed to her a number of sleeping pills that she would take with some sort of anti-nausea concoction and some other lethal thing. And with a friend and Chabot present and the music of Bach playing in the background, she drank all this and died. Well, this made a sensation in Holland, an absolute sensation. And they rang Chabot up on a flagpole and says, you violated the strict guidelines of Netherlands euthanasia law. Says, well, how is that? And the law was written apparently with this a terminal condition criterion there. But then the attorney for Chabot successfully argued that there are lives that are not worth living that have nothing to do with being vexed with some pathology. And she had, I mean, unless you want to say the only kind of pain that's big P pain is physical pain. Is there not intractable mental pain? And when this thing went to court, Chabot was not acquitted. His knuckles were wrapped for having failed to at least have Hilly personally looked at by another physician. But that's the only thing that his hands were wrapped for. But the court decided that he should not be punished. So we're not talking mythology. If you dispense with a terminal condition, you're now in a very interesting zone of, well, what sorts of things then are you going to allow? Well, let me just quit there for a minute. Well, not a minute, I just stopped cold turkey here. I'm sort of interested as to whether you think any of these arguments have the weight to thistle down or comebacks that you have. I mean, do you think that we ought to cross this line? Yeah, your name is
Ken.
Ken.
One thing I wanted to get back to you, the Smith-Jones story just for a bit,
mm-hmm.
And I finally hit on what was bothering me a little bit about that, and that's because that story deals with below the line on your matrix. Both of those cousins were killed involuntarily, and I was looking at your matrix and the letting.
Well, don't
die,
they fall here?
Yeah. Because the cousin didn't say, kill me.
No, that's right. And that makes a moral difference.
Yeah, and so my point is, the words in your matrix might need something to help work with the moral difference between voluntary and involuntary.
Well, Ken, I mean, let me just ask. If you got a medically hopeless patient, I don't know, I may make up a case. I'm not a physician, but maybe this patient is incompetent for some reason. They're senile, they're in a coma or something, but they also have a cardiac problem, and they have infarctions now and then, and we have no codors, and people run, and they resuscitate them. You could issue what's called a no code order for this person and simply say, you know, if they go into arrest again, don't rush in the paramedics and this kind of stuff. But that would also be a case of involuntary letting die, because if the patient hadn't said yay or nay that this is what they want done, it would be the same thing as Jones did to his cousin, right?
Mm-hmm.
It would still be a letting die, but now we have a clinical situation.
Right. My point is that the matrix might be more useful with a differentiation of the terms in the middle. You know, you got killing. You know, what's the difference there? And in my mind, the voluntary killing is is kill me, where involuntary is I kill you.
And you'd want to, Ken, you want to isolate this as murder one.
Well, I'm not going that far. Okay. I'm just saying there should be a difference if the matrix is to be useful in the terms you're using. And I would do the same thing on letting die. Let me die, I will let you die. That might be helpful to help, you know, differentiate something like the Smith-Jones story and help discuss what your clinical case is about.
So we have a killing, let me just make a genus, and then we have let me die, or kill me.
Kill me and I kill you. Kill me is the voluntary part of
I'm going to kill
knowledgeably,
you.
Yeah. Okay. Or I kill you is there is no voluntary assent, whether there can't be or there isn't for whatever reason.
Okay, now the question is whether there's any moral distinction here. If somebody says, kill me, if you go along with that and kill the person, are you morally whitewashed? Now, the challenge is to think of counterexamples. I mean,
that's your last case for
the 18-year-old woman that says, oh, you know, he walked off and left me.
Right.
Or the, you know, kill me, kill
the
me.
Mental anguish instead of the pathology.
Right. But then I take it that the guy who's attacking my wife and family with a knife doesn't want to be killed either.
Right.
And so I'm killing him. Now, I take it that no one's going to say that that's morally opprobrious. So this is Rachel's point. Again, simply to know it's a case of killing settles nothing interesting. I have to know more. I mean, right. even these are insufficient to draw a distinction. Somebody else had a comment.
For example, before I became a Christian, I would agree with some of those things, but now I'm a Christian. What's the biblical view of
theological? Religion?
Well, I think what it boils down to is, well, let me set up a possible dilemma. Walt can help me out here. There are some people who argue this way, that God is the giver of life, therefore only God has the right to take life, and therefore when we do ourselves in, we usurp a right given to God, and I take this to be a theological argument. Okay? But come at it another way. I would think that agape love would call for us to minister to those in pain and to try and relieve this pain where possible. And if somebody wants this in their case, does agapeistic love require ministering? I mean, is this a matter of healing? Is this a form of healing? I mean, is it?
It's interesting that mercy is the word that tends to get attached to voluntary, active killing. You know, mercy killing, and mercy being a very theological term. Does that relate somehow to the mercy of God? I don't know. That's a real stretch for
me. I'm looking for the theologians in here to help me. I'm a lowly philosopher trying to...
It's difficult to connect, you know, the ethics and the theology because, you know, the first thing you try to do is go to the scriptures and look for some kind of precedent. I don't know of a precedent that talks about this kind of stuff in scripture, per se.
Well, Christ was passive in his death. Walking to the cross.
That's
it
true.
It was a form of suicide, if you want to look at it in certain terms.
And some more...
The Bible is clear in that Jesus could have walked away from it.
But isn't it true, just in my cursory reading, it seems to me that there are all kinds of recorded episodes of suicide, both in the Old and the New Testament.
gospel.
And to my judgment, Walt and somebody else can help me out. I don't know of any, and this includes Judas, by the way. I don't know if any, it strikes me that these stories just stand there, narrated, as something somebody's done, and nobody makes a judgment as to whether it's right or wrong. It's just something which is done. Sometimes we think, well, Judas probably deserved it, or something. I mean, you know, in a way, I mean, this is...
The opprobrium on Judas was not that he committed suicide, but that he betrayed Jesus.
Yes.
Yes.
Right.
And martyrdom has been lifted.
Martyrdom? This was always a problem, you know, for, I think, clerics in the early church, because when, you know, the big people like Domitian and Diocletian and Nero, you know, were running people into Colosseums, they'd be burned at the stake or thrown to the lions, you had people, you know, lining up, you know, trying to get in the line here, and, you know, the clerics would all say, "What? Hold it. You know, what are you doing?" I mean, the counter argument was, I thought you already told us that heaven is my home. I mean, the faster we get there, the better. What is, you know? So this has always been a problem.
Yeah.
And then there is this problem about what God's will is.
Rejoice
here.
In your suffering.
Mm. Pardon?
Rejoice in your suffering.
But then I would think that all of the whole enterprise of medicine deserves damnation, because it just comes in right and left to eliminate suffering, to head off death. Are we gigantic intruders in God's will?
Well,
and somebody said before, who was it, that death is, or life is a terminal condition?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're all going to die. What is unnatural about dying?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, maybe the unnaturalness has to do with how we can stave it off and live to decrepit eras in our life.
Don't you think there's another level going on? Because I think this is going on all the time. This crossing over the line between killing and letting die, with the clergy involved and people of, you know, like, with sincere intentions, and then even finding out about it after the fact, and other people of goodwill interpreting it as, you know, we're just doing the best we can with what we've got, and we don't have all the answers, and we've got to make some decisions. And someday we'll be judged on what we've done. And it can't be put into law. It's another kind of law.
Well, the law can grant us the liberty, and this is what we're worried about, is whether we ought to be granted that liberty.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I guess.
It's when we get that second person in there. It's when, if it's suicide, you know, you can sort of live with that because the person did it to themselves. With the woman you were talking about who played tennis with her son, when that first happened and then she decided that she wanted Kevorkian to help her die, I was very upset, knowing what kind of a life she still could maybe have for who knows how many more months. Then I started working with some Alzheimer's people. And I could see that maybe her thought was, there's going to be a time when I have no more control of what my life's...
You mean the patient is thinking this?
The patient
is
thinking,
and you never know whether...
I won't have any more control past a certain point. I won't be... the dementia will be there. I won't be able to...
And you won't be able to... So let me...
And I want to do it now because I can't trust the people around me to make sure it's done my way.
Is that dishonorable? I mean... Mm-hmm. I'll tell you what has really thickened the plot for me, is that I had an uncle die last year, and I really didn't know much, if anything, about the hospice movement.
Hmm.
But he had bone cancer, and he it was in home hospice. I mean, it was clear that he was dying and was in the end of days for him. He did not need the full armamentarium of 24-hour medical care and acute care hospital. He didn't need this. He just needed pain medication, you know, when he should have it and so forth. And so they had hospice workers that came in during the house numerous times during the day. And as I heard more and more about this from my cousin, who was his son, I began reading more and more about the hospice movement.